Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for listening. This is Lana. I want to thank all my listeners who have sent me an email recently. One of the best things about doing this show is all the unique people I get to meet. I found the people that listen to this show are extremely well-rounded and are interested in many areas. That is my favorite kind of people. People who aren't scared away easily, but have an inquisitive, open mind, not a dogmatic approach. People who can ebb and flow and twist and turn, depending on what comes their way, while holding on to their core values. In April, we at Red Ice will celebrate our 10-year anniversary, and through the years, we've transformed as our knowledge has expanded, as new info and more truth comes our way. We're still transforming. And as you learn new information, your outlook broadens or refines. It's a continual process. We don't know it all, and we're still gathering the pieces. And as we age, the healthy approach is to reassess and review our tactics in life. What do I need to do to become better? How can I get to the next level? Well, at the end of my last program, I mentioned change is upon us. I was pleased that others wrote me saying that they felt the exact same thing too. It's the right time to open the doors and let in fresh air and be inspired again. So what is next for us? My guest today is Colonel Walter T. Richmond, the author of Hasta la Vista, Europe. It was great because when I first called him for the interview, he spoke in Russian, which of course I loved that. It turns out Walter is extremely diverse when it comes to what he can talk about. But today we're focusing on his book, Hasta la Vista, Europe, What You're Not Being Told About the Refugee Crisis and How It's Destroying Europe. He's done a super job compiling straight facts surrounding the so-called refugee crisis, from crimes to cover-ups, from media spins to actual events, from horrific diseases to restricted info. He presents just facts, eyewitness accounts. He doesn't talk about the whos and whys, but compiles the basics that people need to begin with before they even ask those other big questions. Walter is a member of a military veteran family. After graduating basic and officer training at the top of his class and serving in a variety of emergency, law enforcement, and disaster response capacities, Richmond was commissioned as a colonel in the 1990s. He left uniformed services and worked in various TV, radio, communications, and media-related fields. Specializing in strategic messaging, he lectured and wrote about interrelated subjects. Along the way, Richmond watched the mainstream media become increasingly more and more controlled and biased. After observing the ever-growing and disturbing gap between what was actually happening in Europe during the so-called refugee crisis versus what the controlled media was reporting or not reporting, he and some colleagues began tracking the disparities and dissecting the blatant propaganda while seeking the truth. We'll talk all about it. Walter T. Richmond, up next. Walter, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Lana. Pleasure.
Well, I've been following the insanity of the invasion, I call it, of Europe, and I want to rage when I see what is going on, what is happening to Europe, and we're no strangers to this topic. But first, tell us about your background and what inspired you to write the book, Hasta la Vista, Europe.
Yes, I spent many years in uniformed services doing all sorts of disaster relief and emergency service response. And knowing that background, when I saw what was going on in Europe, I looked at it from a pseudo law enforcement military perspective rather than a civilian on the ground. Oh, wow, how do you help those people? I saw civilians in trouble. I saw how emergency apparatus would be used. I saw the different ways that authorities should probably respond to a tragedy of the magnitude that was being portrayed by the media. My second career after I left uniformed services involved communications and corporate communications and media-related fields, and especially strategic messaging. So I then started to see how the stories that the major media, and I called them the old-fashioned controlled media in the book for a specific reason, but the media was really portraying the crisis very differently. So I initially approached it as a typical American media consumer. Oh, wow, that's horrible. It's a refugee crisis. It's like the time that the hurricane hit. We have to send money. We have to help. The more we dug into it, and I say we because I had some friends that we would trade emails back and forth, the more we discovered what we were being told and what we were being shown specifically, Lana, which is another deception the media uses, it really didn't foot. It didn't match with what we saw on the independent videos that you could see on YouTube or wherever else.
So what went through your head when you first started looking into some of the footage and they were showing the migrant crisis in Europe? What were some of your first reactions?
The initial reaction was disconnect. In other words, they told me it was a 6-foot-tall bear. It's a 3-foot-tall rabbit. What's up? And so then we started really looking, a group of people and I, at the different stories that they would put into the news media, and then what was actually being shown on little phone videos and on the internet. And specifically for me, when I saw the migrants acting, and I'm going to interchangeably use refugees, migrants, etc., even though I don't believe anybody, there's no preponderance of refugees in this case. It's mostly migrants and opportunistic migrants at that. But I will tell you that when I saw what was going on, I started to watch how they acted. I've been at hundreds of really bad accident sites and fires and disasters. And I will tell you that these folks were not acting like the people fleeing a disaster that I was used to working with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It seemed like a tap turned on and all of a sudden it was happening, but it must have been oozing its way for some time. Did you look into that, like when this really initially started flooding into Europe?
We did. Once we started to say, hey, this is a message that needs to get out there, we need to tell this story, my associates and I went back. And you can go back in the early 2000s. And there were little red flags that were raised. You know, Sweden is one of the areas that I go over in the book pretty heavily, because if you want to understand what is going to happen in a situation, you look at things that have happened in that type of situation previously. So Sweden has done the let's provide refuge for migrants thing for years. In the 60s, one of their prime ministers stood up at parliament and commented on the race wars that were happening in the United States and said, you know, the reason we have such a wonderfully happy society is because we're homogenous.
Yep.
And within 10 years, Sweden had passed a 1975, I think, law that said we are now going to become multicultural officially. And within 10 years after that, you know, crime rates went through the roof and things went severely bad. So if you want to look back, you can easily find many examples from years ago that should have been red flags to anybody thinking, wow, is this the way to assist? I get assisting people in trouble, but I don't think the methodology is proper.
Well, let's talk about some of these kind of peachy, fuzzy, big lies that were told about, which you write about in the book. Share some of those lies.
Oh, well, let me give you the overarching premise that we work with. We love rainbows. Rainbows are the most beautiful thing on earth because of one thing and one thing alone. They have diverse colors, right?
Yeah.
The thing that typically is twisted off of that is that somehow if you mix all the rainbow colors together, it's going to make it even better. And the answer is no. No, absolutely not. Have you ever taught a kid to paint with watercolors? If they don't keep the brush clean, if they don't keep the colors distinct, eventually there's no more rainbow. It's a
that's
big
right.
gray mess.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's our first, you know, overarching. The media keeps saying how much better it's going to be when we become a rainbow, but they don't tell you that you have to keep the colors distinct and fresh and clean, or you have a mess. The second thing they're telling everybody is that these are poor little Syrian families and refugee families fleeing war. And the average consumer of news goes, oh, that's terrible. What they don't tell you, and the book has all the specifics and all the links, what they don't tell you is that the United Nations themselves admitted that 75% or more of the refugees are young fighting age males. And one of the major newspapers in Israel actually put an article out in which they showed that the BBC's website, the number of pictures that they had on there were not indicative of the 75% young males. So in other words, even the BBC itself was putting out information that made it look like it was all young little kids. The UN has a famous brochure to help the Syrian refugees. And there's a little girl on the cover. The problem is that she may represent a small portion of the actual people. And I think that is one of the big myths that's being floated out. And the third big myth, Lana, is that the refugees are looking to come in, assimilate, melt into the quote-unquote melting pot and become happy new citizens or whatever, fill in the box with the name of the country that they're headed for. And nothing could be further from the truth. Time and time again, and I detail it in the book, migrants set up their own migrant communities. They basically put their own little country within your country, and then they start chipping away at the country. For instance, in Switzerland, the migrants have a big movement to get the cross off the flag because it's offensive to them. So they don't want the Swiss cross on the flag. In Sweden, they burn flags, and the Swedish school system, which is completely out of control with political correctness, has actually thrown kids out of class for wearing a Swedish colored shirt. With the Swedish flag on it, or even it's absolutely out of control. So those are some of the, and there are quite a few other little myths that the media tries to slip in. For instance, migrants are going to become upstanding, happy little citizens, and they're going to follow your rules. And here's the big myth that's really dangerous, and they're going to respect your women. And nothing could be further from the truth on that one.
Yeah, I think you even wrote about a section in there, a woman, I believe it was a German woman. There's been other women who have worked in the camps, right? And what have been some of their experiences?
If you had to pick a poster child for how horrific this situation is, this one is right on spot. It was a German politician in September of 2015 named Julia Klockner. And she decided, oh, wow, I'm going to go to a refugee camp and shake hands and hug people and really show them that Germany is here for them. Instead, the local imam, which is the Muslim cleric, refused to shake her hand or even talk to her because she was a woman and unclean. So I think after that, Klockner suddenly had a complete about face and started a whole litany of laws that she wanted immigrants to sign when they come in and that say, hey, this is Germany and darn it, you're going to follow our rules. So she was awakened very early on.
Now, how is the refugee crisis being managed in Germany from what you've looked into?
It's really not.
No, it's not.
Oh my gosh. I mean, if that's management, it's incredible that they can make sports cars that run. You would think that at a certain point they would understand they're overwhelmed. Now, many German officials have come out and said they're overwhelmed, it's not working, Merkel has to admit that she's done something horrific, it's got to be changed. But the official stance is still, everything is fine, everything is terrific. I actually dissect Merkel's New Year's Eve address at the end of the book and explain what she is saying and what she is likely spinning. Interestingly enough, Angela Merkel, when she was younger, was a uniform-wearing communist.
That's right. I saw the pictures.
Yes. And her friend, and sometimes I think maybe ex-friend, sent pictures into the newspaper, and all of a sudden it was revealed. Now, interestingly, Merkel was in charge or was purportedly part of the group that was in charge of propaganda and opinion spinning. So it wouldn't take a conspiracy theorist to figure out that, something's up, something's not right. And what she's doing at the moment, I think presidential candidate Trump said that what she's done in Europe is absolutely insane. And I would have to say, yes, it's absolutely insane. The management's not there. Now, the thing that's really not getting much attention is the healthcare system. There are three or four different aspects of taking in immigrants, right? If you're in charge of a country, you want to know where you're going to house and feed them. What are they going to do as far as work? Because they're not going to just sit around all day long. And third, how are you going to take care of their health and well-being? The German healthcare system is completely overwhelmed. Doctors are talking about lines out the door. And the migrants, refugees, immigrants, whatever, asylum seekers, whatever you want to call them, don't seem to understand the healthcare system in Europe. So they'll literally walk in and demand attention for a cold over a gunshot victim.
Yeah, I know.
It's gotten so bad, Lana, that they have fistfights. And there are many hospitals that have started to hire bodyguards because the nurses and doctors are being literally punched out.
And now they're also bringing in all these exotic diseases I've heard about, and some strange STDs, like kind of archaic STDs are returning. And
oh, yes. In fact, and what was really interesting to us when we started to look into it, now, if anyone's listening and they go, this isn't real, it can't be happening. The reason that I put in the book all the links to the sources, and a lot of them are primary sources, by the way. So if you read German, you're in luck. If not, you'll have to translate it. But it shows you where we got the information from. We're not making up little stories just to rabble rouse. It's literally there. And one of the amazing things about the doctors is that the in Germany, the press quickly ran to try to make believe it wasn't a problem, that it hadn't happened, that there was no leprosy, that there were no things. But in November 2015, German doctors were put on alert because, quote, one of the doctors said they were facing health challenges they hadn't faced in decades.
Well,
vaccines were short. They were looking around. These migrants were attacking doctors and nurses, physically beating them up or hacking at them. One migrant didn't like the way a nurse talked to him, went down to a store, bought an axe, and came back to chop her head open, and luckily was stopped. So, I mean, it's all in the book. I will tell you, we could go on for hours about what's not being managed in Germany.
Now, are most European countries, are they bound by migrant quotas?
Interestingly enough, when they formed the EU, England, Ireland, and Denmark were excluded.
Hmm.
So, well, and I will tell you, in practice, they're not bound. And they can literally, I think Poland was one of the examples I use in the book, can actually pay to get out of it. So in other words, you're bound to take 10,000 migrants. However, give us 0.00 whatever of your GDP and we'll let you pass for 1 year. In the meanwhile, England, Ireland, and Denmark were officially excluded from migrant quotas, so they're doing it out of the goodness or naive goodness of their hearts, if they're doing it at all.
And then it seems that the Slavic countries, for now anyway, they're actually providing the greatest resistance to some of these invasions, correct?
They are. Hungary's Prime Minister Orbán was the leading voice, and it's interesting. And I think this is very typical of people that are in a situation where, for instance, a home invasion, at first they don't believe it's happening, then they figure out it is happening, maybe we can reason with people, and then finally they say, we either do something or we're dead. And I think Orbán was the voice of reason, and most people didn't believe him. He kept saying, these are invaders, this is an invasion, I'm not sure what's going on, there's a bigger plot here, but I can't figure it out, or I don't want to say what it is. And the other countries in that Slavic block area pretty much followed. Croatia, Slovenia, Hungary especially, and the Czech Republic, they all pushed immigrants back and forth, but ultimately I don't think any of them were very happy with the situation whatsoever. In fact, some of the countries tried to make it as easy as possible for migrants to move through to Germany or Austria or wherever, and making it not so pleasant for them to stay. Which, yeah, I think is by design. And hey, listen, Lana, I will tell you while we're on it, before I forget, one of the crazy things that we noticed as we were putting the book together, we never, ever found one instance of the old-fashioned controlled media ever praising anybody, police officer, citizen, fireman, whoever, for protecting their country.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. It, right away, you know, if you don't believe what they're telling you, you're a xenophobe, a racist, whatever.
Well, Sweden has just said, too, is one of their high up officials, you know, in the police department's like, well, we can't guarantee your safety anymore. So you're on your own. So what does that mean? That's going to mean there's going to be have to be groups of guys that then have to ensure that the people are safe, right?
Yes. And, you know, that's got bad written all over it.
Yeah.
You know, from a law enforcement background, that has just got bad written over it. But it's not unique. I mean, the German police basically threw in the towel in Hamburg. I mean, do you think 20,000 pickpocketing incidents a year is a nice place to go as a tourist?
No.
You got to be out of your mind. They're in trouble. Sweden has over 55 no-go zones, which some of the newspapers print and sometimes they don't. But a no-go zone means you don't go. And if you're in the police department, you understand how bad that is. it means that you can't respond without at least one or two other units backing you up, and you expect to be shot at, have things thrown at you. The big thing that the migrants are doing these days is laser. They take little red lasers and they try to blind the cops, because it doesn't take too many seconds. One of those pointing laser pen things. If you pointed at someone's eye, you could blind them rather quickly.
There was also in Germany, too, where they were saying, let the petty crimes go, refugees. They don't know any better. They're here. They're just learning. And I was thinking, if it was a German or a Swede that was born there, they wouldn't just be letting it go. They'd be busting them, right?
Oh, busting them. It's unbelievable. The disparity, the heavy hand of the law, beats down the locals and coddles the migrants. There are so many examples that we wrote about that are just some, aren't some of them just sickening at a certain point?
Yeah.
And the worst are the rapes, because I will tell you that nothing is more horrible than the rape statistics that you'll see in the European countries that have got this influx of migrants. And consistently the migrants are slapped on the wrist or let go, or it's not even fathomable for the horrific crimes that you'll read about. And then when you see what happened to them, you go, no, it can't be. It can't be.
I know. It's unbelievable that our people in Europe are even allowing this to happen. It's outrageous. You also wrote, there was a section in the book about how local populations are basically, they're responsible to house and feed and even entertain some of these migrants that show up at their doorstep, right?
Oh, it was unbelievable. Some of the German towns were actually grabbing school kids to, under the guise of, well, we'll have a class outing and you'll learn, home economics. Instead, they were taking the migrant shelters for them to clean up after the migrants. So let me tell you, some of the parents found out and the social media just exploded with outrage. But yes, and what happens is it's worse than most people know, because people are literally being displaced time and time again. You will read about instances where elderly people, pensioners, which is kind of the word for retirees in Europe, right? Because they're on pensions, are being thrown out of, displaced, or moved out of their current housing, where some of them have lived their whole lives,
yeah,
could be 20, 30, 40 years, because developers are moving in, knocking the place down or retooling it for migrant housing. And that, immediately the town that it's in usually gets a huge chunk of change from the government. And of course, the real estate guy that puts the shelter up makes a lot of money. In the meanwhile, these poor people who are the locals are out on their, they're out on the street.
Yeah, that's right. It's big business. There's some capitalists that are making lots of money through this refugee crisis.
I just want to talk about Spain. Here's what's crazy about, because we're talking about housing. Currently in 2014, maybe a year ago, statistics lag, but there were 4.1 million homeless Europeans in Europe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So 4.1 million homeless Europeans running around in dire straits. As of September 2015 in Europe, of all the foreclosed empty houses, a third of them were in Spain. There were 3.4 million foreclosed empty houses in Spain, and the Spanish government then revealed there were another 500,000 partially built houses where the developer had run out of money and it was just sitting half built. Can you imagine in Spain, every day, 95 homes are seized by banks a day from Spanish families where they're now on the street or wherever? And at the same time, there were special interest groups in Europe calling for the migrants to be housed in these homes.
Outrageous.
No, it's beyond outrageous. And then back to that statistics. If there are 4.1 million homeless people in Europe and 3.4 million empty homes in Spain, and a lot more across the board, there's a house for every homeless European. Why can't we fix that first?
I mean, even in England, I was shocked at the statistics of old people dying because they can't afford to heat their homes. So they're getting sick and dying in England every year. But yet they can bring in all these people and house them and pay for them and let them be there for free.
I think that the disconnect for us, again, just like with a home invasion, at first you can't believe what is happening, why is it happening, and then, oh my gosh, if we play along with them, it'll be fine. And then you realize we got to do something or we're dead. I think that that type of victim mentality must be ingrained in European, some Europeans, because they're sitting there watching this happen. And I will tell you, in defense of Europeans, some of their laws against criticizing the government are pretty horrific.
Oh, yes, they are. Yeah.
You know what's going on in Sweden. You basically can't criticize anybody or bad things happen. And it's duplicitous because remember when Charlie Hebdo got the terrorist attack in Charlie Hebdo?
Yeah, sure.
And I guess that was in 2015, the beginning of the year. And Sweden's prime minister took a trip out to France, and he's Prime Minister Löfven, L-O-F-V-E-N. And he went over there and made a big deal about marching with all these other heads of state about freedom of expression and supporting freedom of speech, press, all this other stuff. At the same time, there's a fella named Dan Park, who's a Swedish artist, who has been sitting in jail at one point for 6 months.
That's right. We've had him on Red Ice, by the way.
Oh, have you? Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm preaching to the choir. But here's a fella that offends some minority groups with some art that he put out. And he's in jail for 6 months and gets fined. And at the same time, the prime minister of the country that did that to their own artist is marching in Paris, you know, in support of Charlie Hebdo, which arguably has probably put out far more offensive and disgusting art than this guy, Park. But I mean, it's just a sign of the times. It's interesting. If it's for migrants, it's okay. If it's locals, you know, beat them in the head.
Let's talk about the media, because obviously they're using cover-up techniques so that you don't know what's really going on over there. You talk about this in your book. So what are some of the techniques that they're using to push their agenda supporting this refugee crisis?
Oh, in the chapter, Hungary and Media Spin, we go over some of those. And let me give you the three specific ways that the media does stuff. A is to completely change, fake, do things. And so one of the examples in the book, they had the case of maybe a half dozen or maybe a few less local rapists. And they called them local rapists, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they used cut out silhouettes in the newspaper to make it look like they were Europeans. The reality was they weren't local, they weren't citizens, they were migrants, and they were from North Africa. But you couldn't tell that from the picture. So they'll fake stuff. Another way the media fakes stuff, for instance, is with that George Zimmerman trial, that famous tape where Zimmerman it was used to make him sound like a racist. In fact, he was answering the questions that the dispatcher was asking him. She asked him, was he white, black, or Hispanic? And he goes, he's black. He looks black, something along those lines. Yet the media intentionally spliced the tape to make it sound like he was describing this guy's activities and then said, and it's because, you know, basically it's because he's black. So the media is, and they were caught, and then they apologized and they admitted that they did it. And then they had no explanation on why they did it. But so the media can fake things and change things. For instance, the visual aspect of deception. They're showing us many pictures, many more pictures of little children and little families rather than the 75% fighting age males, right?
That's right.
And that is an absolutely easy way. So you almost don't hear, right? It depends on how you learn. But I will tell you, most people, what they see is what they believe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll hear, and all the migrants are, you know, and they may even hear 75% are young male, but the pictures that are constantly blown into their face are the little sad family fleeing war.
Or the drowned Syrian boy, for instance. That was a huge one. I can believe how many people were duped by that.
Oh, my goodness. And in the chapter on Turkey, we actually spent almost the entire chapter going over that case because it's just so indicative of media spin. I mean, I don't know how deeply you went into it, but the father of this kid was identified by quite a few eyewitnesses, and we had to watch the tapes in Turkish and get a translator so we could understand what was happening, because sometimes the media hides things in plain sight. you see it, but they just don't explain it to you. You don't have a translator, so you don't know what's happening. But apparently, there's quite a bit of evidence, and I don't know if they've ever done anything with it, that he actually directly had caused the death of his family and some other children of another family that he was transporting. One of the two or three eyewitnesses said he was the human trafficker, not just a person on the boat.
Interesting.
Yeah. And oh,
what about the dentist story? Is that true? They were just trying to go to the dentist. I mean, they have dentists in Turkey.
So one of my buddies calls me up from Washington, D.C. and says, no, it has nothing to do with that. He wanted money for the dentist. And I said, you're out of your mind. It can't be, because in Colorado, if you leave your dog in the car without enough water and the windows cracked and it gets too hot or too cold and something happens to the dog, right, you go to jail, right? So how much worse is it for a father to take a child without a life jacket, stick him in a dinghy, and stick him in the Mediterranean Sea and say, we're going across the ocean?
Sure, yeah, irresponsible.
Callous irresponsibility. And yet, this guy's sister, the Abdullah Cardi's sister, the guy that was the father of the boy that drowned, said on Canadian TV that she had collected money because he wanted his teeth fixed, and his father actually thought of the idea, and they had wired him money, but he didn't have the money. It was a convoluted story, but the bottom line was the man was trying to get to Europe so that he could eventually get his teeth fixed, more than likely for free, somewhere in Europe. The twisted part was at the end where, Lana, if you were escaping war and a horrific situation and all of a sudden your kids die, would you take them back to the place you escaped from to bury them?
Exactly. That was very weird.
Right. So then when this guy finally then takes his kids and buries the three of them in the war-torn area that he just escaped from, big air quotes, the suspicion just didn't warrant his actions. It just... anybody in law enforcement would instantly look at it and go, I don't think so.
Furthermore, I mean, the Gulf countries, they have dentists there. Why didn't he just go somewhere closer?
I think it's because they're expensive. you can't get liquor in Dubai, and the hotel rooms are $600 a night.
Yep, they've got a lot of oil money over there.
You bring up a good question, though. The Gulf states are an enigma because if you believe what the Gulf states are saying, they've done a lot. They've taken in a lot of refugees, et cetera, et cetera. If you believe what the other countries around them are saying, they've done literally next to nothing. I think the big 800-pound gorilla in the room is, quite frankly, the Ukraine, where the United Nations last year or 6 months ago revealed that there are 5 million Ukrainians that need immediate humanitarian aid.
Wow, 5 million, huh?
5 million, UN. We have the links to it. No one did a story about it because the Ukrainians aren't interesting.
So, what about those refugees? They don't matter, though, because they're European, right?
More than likely, it's some sort of political play. The Ukrainians should really think about what they're trying. They're trying to get into the EU, and they're so desperate to get into the EU that they've sat down with the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the IMF is giving them some sort of multi-billion-dollar promise.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's worse than you can imagine. Putin tried to get in there to save his fellow Slavs by saying, no, don't take the money from them. I'll give you the money before you take it from them, but they want to be in the EU. I think it's at a certain point, people grow up and they always wanted a Corvette, and it doesn't matter how they're going to get the Corvette, they want the Corvette.
So what do you say to people who are like, but the children, I always hear that. Women are always saying that, like, Europe is supposed to take the weight of the world. We can do it. You know, how do you respond to people like that?
They're absolutely right. It is about saving the children. The issue is there are very few children amongst the refugees. And here's what the statistics have brought out. There are so many young males, adult males, pretending to be children, it defies the imagination. I believe it was Norway. They did a sampler, and they found out that 90% of the people that said that they were unaccompanied minors, which is their word for children,
were 30.
were men. And we have quite a few examples, but there again, you'd probably want to link to them because visually what you see, and the media gushes over this wonderful child and they're restarting their lives, blah, blah, blah. And you're looking at the picture and you're going, that's a freaking old man.
Yeah, I know.
It's an old man. And there's no question in your head. I will tell you, in November 2015, Swedish government report on asylum seekers, they said, A, 71% were males, and that's where they claimed 90% of those that were claiming to be children were young males. Why do they do it, Lana? For a couple of reasons. If they claim, well, first of all, loads of people are claiming to be Syrian when they're not, because Syrians get the most lucrative setups. Okay, so the first thing you want to do if you're a migrant is claim you're a Syrian.
Mm-hmm.
And in Germany, they caught loads of North Africans claiming to be Syrians, and the German police were laughing, going, hey, man, visually, we can tell you're not Syrian.
Exactly.
But the minute they say they're Syrian, now you're stepping on their civil rights, so you can't say they're not. Secondly, about the children thing, a lot of countries in Europe, if you're under 15, or fill in an age, but in many countries, if you're under 15, they can't punish you with jail time. So we detail an inordinate amount of examples of rapists and criminals that have claimed that they were under 15 and they don't do jail time. And that's one of the other reasons. And the third reason is they tend to get streamlined. If you claim you're a child, especially a Syrian child, the asylum seeking process, it goes into overdrive and you get in quickly.
Now tell us about the Child Soldiers Prevention Act. I didn't know about this, but you mentioned it in the book.
Yes. A while back, the United States said, hey, listen, there are a lot of these flaky countries that are actually using children as soldiers. And they're either training them to be militant or they help out on the front lines by carrying supplies or whatever. Or believe it or not, they actually use some of the young girls as prostitutes. It's horrific. So the United States passed a law that said you can't do business with a country that does these things. And secondly, if you're one of the people from a country that does these things and you step foot anywhere near the United States, we're locking you up. We're throwing away the key. And we don't care where you did it. You could have been recruiting child soldiers in Syria. But if we catch you in the U.S., you're going to jail. And the question that I always had is, if so many of these refugees are coming from countries that have child soldiers and instituted child soldier plans, who's checking them? Yeah. Not only are these kids coming over and saying that they're, you know, the young adults who are saying that they're children, but on top of it, who's checking the kids? Shouldn't there be a program that says, hey, will you train to kill as a way to resolve a conflict? Do you really want little children, you know, 10, 12, 14 year olds running around thinking that it's okay to bayonet someone in the head if they don't like them or to solve an issue? I think a lot of the violence that you see amongst the young migrant children stems from the fact that many of them came from countries where violence was accepted, or it was a way of life, maybe not accepted, but it was an unfortunate way of life. Or I'm betting that quite a few were child soldiers. Forbes magazine reported that about 300,000 children right now are taking part in conflicts all over the world. And they come from the 27 countries that are in that act, which is the Child Soldier Act, including Afghanistan and Chad and Democratic Republic of the Congo, Iran, Iraq, all the areas. Somalia especially is overrepresented in criminal activity in many of the migrant communities. So it just gives one pause for concern, wouldn't you say?
Of course. Hey, you also have a chapter called Learning from Lebanon, which I thought was interesting. What happened to Lebanon? It was considered like the Switzerland of the Middle East, right?
It was. And people sometimes think of Lebanon and they remember all sorts of conflict and exploding bombs and bombed out areas. The reality is, at a certain point, Lebanon was actually, yes, what you said is correct. It was considered the Switzerland of the Middle East. You could swim in the Mediterranean Ocean and then go up to their Emzar massive ski resort, which is actually amidst Roman temple ruins. I mean, how cool is that? You get to a ski resort and there are literal Roman temple ruins all around you. And at a certain point, Beirut, which is the capital of Lebanon, decided they wanted to do a showcase on Switzerland or the Middle East. So they had some really nice shows. They invited people and they really started to whip up tourism. By 2011 and 2013, because of wars and refugee crises, etc., Lebanon lost almost 1 million tourists. Now about 66% of their population is considered poor. That's completely devastating. So Lebanon went from doing fine to 66% of the people poor, their own people. They also have a big problem because they have about 500,000 refugee children they expect to have to school over the next couple of years. Their infrastructure that their social affairs minister, Derbys, went on record as saying, hey, listen, we have an infrastructure. We projected it would last 15 years with the people we had in our country. Now it's so worn out and overused by refugees that we're going to have to rebuild it in 2 years. If you stack that all together, there was an official report that came out that said Lebanese citizens have now become partners in deprivation. And that phrase itself, partners in deprivation. Can you imagine you're in a country that has gone so far out to help, and now not only has it backfired, but your people are completely deprived of basic services.
Well, that's what's going to happen to Europeans.
Oh, no question. And here's the wacky thing. In September 2015, maybe a month or two before the Paris attacks, a very concerned Lebanese minister of education, I think his name is Boussaab, warned British Prime Minister David Cameron that 2% of the migrants were radicals and they're looking to cause havoc and terror all over Europe. And he also, Boussaab also said, and they're going to come in through Turkey into Greece. Now, 2% doesn't sound like a big number, right? Oh, you know, what's 2%? But if you take 1 million people and you're looking at 2% of them, you're talking about thousands and thousands of people that are now terrorists. Let me ask you a question, Lana. If you knew that two cherries in a bowl of 400 cherries were poisonous, would you eat any of them?
No, of course not.
Yeah. So that's what the warning from the Lebanese minister was. Hey, 2% of the migrants coming in are guaranteed terrorists. They've been tracking them. We know who their cell sites are. We're warning you. And instead, they're letting people in and they don't even check. The German government just admitted that maybe 300,000 people got into Germany without 200. They actually said 290,000 migrants got into Germany without registering. Without registering means they weren't even checked.
Oh, you're just being paranoid. Relax.
Oh, no doubt.
So why did the UN point to Azerbaijan as a model for how to successfully take in refugees?
Yeah, Azerbaijan was actually cited by one of the UN officials as a model refugee system because they gave citizenship to refugees and they helped them assimilate, etc. Here's the part that no one dissected and is essential. Yes, it was very successful in Azerbaijan because the people they took in weren't that different from them.
Exactly.
They had the same religion. They spoke similar languages. They had similar backgrounds and experiences. It's pretty much like the Slavic phenomenon. You know, Polish and Ukrainians and Croatians and Russians, they all get into a room and complain and fight and who's better and whatever, but they are still Slavic. It is a very similar situation as Azerbaijan was giving refuge to local people that were very similar to them. And so while the UN says that it's a successful model, they're right, but the reason it's successful was never addressed.
Well, that's a huge reason. You know?
Oh, it's huge. So many people. How about the French governors or politicians who came out and said to the French authorities, hey, we'll love to take refugees. Here's what we need. We need refugees that are made up of family units and that there are Christians so they can come into our country, France, and assimilate well. And that became this huge racist boo-hoo. Oh, how can you say that? Oh my gosh, that's terrific. That's horrific. How could you think that way in the 21st century? The reality is that was stacking the odds for success. The German police did the same thing. At a certain point, they got sick and tired of the riots. So they separated all the migrants by religion. Now, there was huge blowback. Oh, that's horrible. That's xenophobic. That's racist. That's Islamophobic. And the German police said, yeah, okay, send us a letter. And they separated Christians from Muslims and really cut down the violence. Now, were they able to successfully stay that way? I don't know. We weren't able to follow up with those statistics because a lot of times stuff is done and then it just disappears.
Now, some people say, well, we just need a limit on refugees and then it will be okay. We can handle it. But why won't a limit work? Isn't there some kind of family loophole too?
Yes, there is. So here's kind of how those numbers work. And it's pretty much a Ponzi scheme with almost no end. So, for instance, Germany wants to take in 1.5 million refugees, right? And we'll use these as, for instance, statistics. There's a provision in the EU that says refugees have a right, once they're established, whatever that means, to bring over close family members. Luckily, most of the refugees are very prolific breeders, so they have loads of family. So on the low end, if we say that each refugee has four family members, and I don't think that's a crazy statistic, right? Four family members, 1.5 million refugees at four family members would be an additional 6 million people plus the refugees again. So you've got 6 million plus the 1.5, you're at 7.5 million. So 1.5 million means 7.5. Lana.
Yeah, that's a lot of people.
What if they have eight relatives each, which is the statistical run the UN says, especially in Middle Eastern and North African countries? If it's eight relatives, now you're at 13.5 million people that you can expect to bring in based on the 1.5 that came in. And that's just crazy. And, you know, we asked the question, okay, are these people educated? Do they have qualifications? What's the background on the educational side? Because at the beginning, remember I said, if you have a country and you're bringing in migrants, you need to know how you're going to feed them, how you're going to house them. Well, how are you going to educate them, or what will they do? And here are the 2 points. Germany has determined that 81% of the migrants that they've gotten so far have no formal qualifications. Do you get what I just said?
Oh, yeah, of course.
81% have no formal qualifications. They have nothing. The UN, in a survey that has been proven to be rather suspect and not scientific, instead said 86% claimed that they have university educations. The issue is, you can quickly figure out that there were no universities where these people came from. So let's dump the UN figures for now. Let's go with the German figures of 81% have no formal qualifications. And now let's look at unemployment. Why is unemployment important? Well, you've got these 75% of the people coming over are young fighting age males. Keeping them working, or letting them have the ability to do something meaningful, working, finding a job of some sort, is key for any of these plans to work. If 81% have no formal qualifications, and unemployment rates in Europe range anywhere from 7% to 50%, right? Greece is in the 50% range for young people. Germany's in the 7% range. Whatever it is, it's not good. Where are these people going to work? And if they do want to work, what are their qualifications? Well, most of them don't have any.
And I just keep hearing how they're supposed to enrich the European workforce and how we need them, right? We'll fall apart without them.
Lana, you have a certain way with words, which is outstanding. I will tell you that the enriching part is correct, but it's not to enrich anyone but themselves. I think that they are economic opportunists in many cases, who are looking for the best deal they can get. This was not my opinion, by the way. This is the opinion of quite a few politicians, and the quotes are in the book, if anyone cares to look them up, who came out flat out and said, they're shopping us around. One of the comments, which I loved the best, was, these don't look like migrants. They look like unhappy tourists. And many of the complaints, and I have some funny ones too, that, you know, one of the migrants is on a video screaming that the food is not fit for dogs. Because,
yeah, I saw that one.
He doesn't like the food in Finland. Ugh. Well, maybe you shouldn't have gone to Finland. You know, if I went to Japan, I wouldn't scream and yell about sushi.
Oh, yeah. There were guys complaining about there was no nightclubs, or guys saying, me want sex, you know, my balls big, you know, like,
yes.
Just craziness.
And I happen to have seen that video. It came out after we published. But I will tell you, every day you turn around, that was one of the worst parts about writing the book. Every day that we thought, okay, we're pulling the trigger, we can publish today, something else came up that we discovered. And we stopped the presses and put it in. And here's something really weird as an offshoot. One of the other things we noticed is as we were doing the book, and we would go in and we would try to meticulously check and recheck and source and resource anything we put in the book, right? Sure, we might have made some mistakes and some stuff may have gone in that isn't as accurate as it could have been, but we tried our hardest. And here's something weird. Sometimes we would go back to videos and the videos had disappeared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in the government, we had a term called, you know, he was disappeared, meaning he was gone. No one asked any more questions. He's gone. And the question is, who's disappearing the videos and why? And literally, you'll see copyright violation, channel no longer, user gone. But it's disconcerting, quite frankly, to see so many videos that are not pleasant about migrations.
Now, what was the inspiration for you also to detail? I think, and I said this before we started, I think your book is great for disbelievers to come and to read it and to really kind of have things laid out for them without getting too political or telling them too much, you know, just kind of whetting their appetite a little bit. But you also detail a lot of the violence and mayhem, correct?
Yes. And I think that if you want to wake people up, you have to give specific examples. It can't be just, now, by the way, we didn't cherry pick the most violent examples. We actually left out quite of the most horrific rapes and crimes and tortures and stuff because it really was just getting to be too much. But we put in enough that the reader will hopefully say to themselves, there's a huge problem. And this isn't what I'm being told. I haven't seen this on my local news. You've got to be kidding me. And the way we structured it and the way I structured it was to make sure that we put in enough to make sure people realize this is not a joke. This is not a small, limited, isolated incident in some far off place. There is a huge pattern. For instance, remember the New Year's Eve rapes? Well, initially, the police made believe nothing happened, right, in Germany. And all of a sudden, every time we were about to print, more women came forward. On our galleys for our printer, we had 346 women came forward in Cologne, Germany, that had been attacked. Then it was 400. Then it was 5. When we published the book, it was over 800. And I think that the statistics really make you wonder what's going on. Our audience is absolutely for people who are not, I don't know if it's non-believers, because non-believers may just never want to believe, but definitely people who have not understood or thought about or heard about what's going on. This
and
is
sadly,
a
lot of Americans don't, they're not paying attention to what's happening in their homeland of Europe, are they?
No, not at all. And, you know, I will say that America should be most interested because most Americans have roots in Europe.
Yeah.
And that may be almost all of the early settlers that came over were from different European backgrounds.
And the other thing is, this refugee crisis is heading to America. I mean, they're already relocating them and massive amounts of quote-unquote refugees in places like Montana and Idaho and these remote little rural towns. I'm sure you know about that.
I am very familiar with that, and it's absolutely crazy. In October 2015, U.S. Congressman Gohmert from Texas asked the FBI director the following question about the Syrian database, because the FBI keeps databases on different possible migrants. He said, well, without a good fingerprint database, without good identification, how can you be sure that anyone who is who they say they are, and if they don't have fingerprints to go against? And the FBI director, Comey, answered, the only thing we can query is information that we have. So if we have no information on someone, they've never crossed our radar screen. They've never been a ripple in the pond. There will be no record of them, and so it will be challenging. So basically, they're saying that dozens of terrorists have currently slipped through a far more robust database, the Iraq database that we used to screen people against, right? The FBI had a big Iraq possible terrorist database. And even with that, dozens of terrorists slipped through, right? And they created mayhem all over the United States, and they continue to create mayhem. And now we're swinging the door open based on a database which is completely meaningless and weak, the Syrian database. So it's absolutely terrifying to think that not only do we know we don't know, but we're still going ahead with this plan to bring people in. I will tell you that of the terrorists that have been here, they haven't been homegrown. The most recent terrorists have all come over, you know, learned their craft, melded in, collected guns, knives, bombs, whatever, and then went on rampages.
Oh, yeah, we've seen plenty of examples of that already here. So is there plans to send all these people home after the wars? What about helping them rebuild in their country? Have you heard anybody talking about these ideas?
Yeah, Angelina Jolie said that, you know, the fondest thing, she's a UN special envoy, ambassador, or whatever, and she made an interesting comment. She said, on the BBC News broadcast in 2004, so Angelina Jolie says, in countries where people have to flee their homes because of persecution and violence, political solutions must be found, peace and tolerance restored, so that refugees can return home. In my experience, going home is the deepest wish of most refugees. Okay, that's great. The reality, it couldn't be further from that, because the refugees aren't returning, except for that one fella, you know, Kurdi, who went back to Syria to bury his wife and kids. Very few refugees return.
Yeah.
They set up shop. And Lana, the worst thing is that there's no incentive for them to return to their home. They've got a salary, which, by the way, the migrants call their welfare payments salaries. I mean, how twisted is that? But they have their money. They have their housing. They have their own communities. Why does Sweden have 55 no-go zones where cops won't go and ambulances won't go and even postal workers won't go anymore? Because they set up their own enclaves. They control the streets. They have their own gangs. They build their own infrastructure. And so many migrants never bother to learn the language.
Of course. And they've also, they come over and then they learn some of the liberal lingo, what to use. Like if you just say, oh, you're being racist or xenophobic, they know that white people will pay out and give them more money and bend over backwards to prove that they're not racists, right? Oh,
no question. In fact,
and they're being hustled.
Yeah, they're being hustled and they just have to say, okay, fine. Call me what you want to call me. That's great. You know, so what? And all of a sudden, the sting of the labeling goes away. But no one's, you know, very few people are willing to just say, yeah, okay, whatever. Call me what you want. I don't care. Because they do. They've been taught, oh, you must worry about what other people think of you. I think that as far as the effect on the economies, it's also pretty devastating. We talked about Lebanon losing 1 million tourists a year. Greece has lost so many tourists. Greece is a failed country, right? Yep. They're a mess. You know, someone was talking about selling the Parthenon to make IMF payments.
Or ugh,
so they're a mess. They know they're a mess. They're trying so desperately to fix themselves. I mean, these are the Greeks. They gave us culture and society, and now they're a mess. And all you can see is these migrants flooding through Greece, making a mess of the country, and tourism is down. If you had a chance to go somewhere where there are going to be migrants running around, misbehaving, doing whatever.
Like Calais? Versus,
like Calais, France, the jungle, you know, that whole mess over there. Would you in your right mind do it? Now, there'll be quite a few people that say, well, nothing's going to happen. I was there. Everything's fine. Yes, you had a wonderful experience and you were lucky. And there are so many more people that didn't have a wonderful experience.
Yeah, there's been people doing videos in Calais. I watched a woman just the other day and she was crying and talking about how they've lost their place, their house now. They can't make money because their town is destroyed. No one's coming. They're literally homeless now and the government is not helping them. And instead they're taking over their house and then they're putting refugees in there. And all the other people are leaving the town because it's just so horrible to live in. I mean, this is awful.
It is. And what you just described, if you strip out the word Calais or France, you could pretty much cookie cutter that story into Greece, into parts of Italy, into parts of Hungary before they closed the borders. This was happening and is happening all over Europe. We rarely hear about it, and it's sad because it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be. The world the Europeans are smart enough to figure this out without opening their doors and having this influx that they can't handle. I mean, I think, quite frankly, it's much more than a refugee crisis. I think it's really a demographic shift crisis. And that's frankly what it really starting to look like. Europe will never be the same. It's going to become something different if they can't figure it out real fast. I mean, look at the UK. Everybody has these wonderful thoughts. Oh, I'm going to London. I'll have warm beer and listen to the, you know, Big Ben striking. And yet they have Sharia patrols on the streets where Muslims get together, put on vests and heckle you if you're drinking or wearing inappropriate clothes. They call the girls sluts. They scream death to Britain, death to the UK, death to the police, and they are protected by the police who protect them from what they say are the xenophobes. And here's a point I want to make. Here's the really crazy thing. The authorities, the police, the people on the ground are actually protecting migrants from this mythical xenophobic, racist, local group.
Well,
that's what bugs me.
I mean, in your view, with your background, do you think that eventually some, you know, wise police and military will revolt against this and stage a coup at some point to say, no, we're going to protect our own. These people are criminals and they need to be removed.
You never know. You really never know, because I will tell you from personal experience on the ground, how people will act in the heat of the moment is often very different from how they say they will act. Secondly, quite frankly, a lot of these folks are doing rather well economically and they just don't want to rock that boat. They've got their little law enforcement gig and they are doing what they can, probably within the system, to help out. But they're really not going to stand up against anybody. There are literally thousands of examples of enforcement against locals to the detriment of local people in favor of migrants day in and day out. Every time you turn around, there's a story where migrants were favored over locals. The rape cases that you read about, it's sickening. It's sickening.
I know.
In one of the cases, they said that the girl who had been gang raped multiple times by these four Somali migrants wasn't helpless enough, so they let them go. I mean, how do you do something like that? It's just, you know.
And then what's going to happen is if, you know, the fathers and the brothers and some guys in the towns get together to take care of business, the military and the cops will turn on their own and probably even kill their own.
Do you know the IKEA case? In Sweden, in IKEA, an African migrant who had snuck into Sweden from Italy, right? So he got his first call of port. His safe country was Italy. And that's the way it works in the EU. The first country you get to that's part of the EU that accepts immigrants is your safe country, and you've got to stay there and not jump around. So he got into Italy, really didn't like Italy, decides, you know what, I'm going to go to Sweden. I hear so much great stuff about it. They'll pay me a bigger salary, quote unquote. Gets there. Within a month, the Swedes get him at the immigration office and say, oh, no, you're getting deported. And so he goes with his buddy to IKEA, finds the knife display, grabs two big butcher knives, and according to his testimony at his murder trial, finds the two most Swedish-looking people he can find, a mother and son that were innocently shopping in IKEA, and hacks them to death.
Yeah,
right?
I know.
Now there was this whole controversy. Did he try to behead them? Did he not? Who cares? The bottom line is he hacked two Swedes to death for looking too Swedish. And what happened immediately after the attack? The Swedish police started patrols to protect who? Who do they try to protect? The people, the locals, because migrants have gone nuts and they've got knives and they're going to chop you up too for looking too Swedish? No. The police started to protect the migrants from, quote unquote, their words, dark forces in Swedish society, and end quote. So even there, they twisted it, Lana, to make it about the migrants. So there's a 40-year-old migrant in Sweden who rapes a 3-year-old girl in a shelter. And fill in, you know, I'll give you some choices. Do A, the shelter call the police? Do the shelter workers quickly isolate him so that when the cops get there, they can take care of business? Do they protect the child from him? No. The answer is the shelter and the migration, the Swedish Migration Board people moved the 40-year-old child rapist who had just raped a 3-year-old girl to hide him for his safety.
That's right. I remember that.
That is so sick. So anyway,
I mean, that's what I mean. Sweden is so insane that they need to be stopped. The people that are running the show there need to be removed. I mean, at a certain point, this is going to become, it is now, a moral obligation, you know? So I'm hoping that people are out there organizing. I hope that there's some guys on the inside that are thinking some of these things to take back their country for the future of their people.
Yeah, I fear for Sweden because recently they changed their constitution, and that's a big deal, to include penalties for insulting migrants and politicians.
That's right.
On the internet or something like that. So I fear for them because, you know, in America, we tend to complain, about stuff and it's just not the way it used to be. But, you know, to change the constitution because you might insult someone, that's nuts. I'll tell you that there's another problem. It's not just a culture of allowing migrants to do stuff, but it's also bending over backwards to the detriment of your own people. The Bishop of Stockholm, who is openly lesbian, didn't want to offend Muslims in a church where she was letting them gather. So she ordered all the crosses to be taken down.
I remember that. Yeah.
Now the cool thing that we mention in the book is we hope that if she ever, and she kept calling them her little angels or something along this line.
Don't they stone gaze though?
Yeah, she's gay. Yeah, well, there are two levels of punishment, and one of them is hundreds of lashes, and the other one, if you continue your homosexual activity, then you get stoned to death. And our point was, since she is married and a happy lesbian marriage, we're guessing that she's getting the death penalty because she's more than likely done that more than a few times. The question is, if it's okay to tear down our crosses, what else can you tear down? That's nuts. Do Muslims tear down their minarets because we're coming to visit them? You heard in Italy they covered up all the statues because some Muslims were coming to visit in Rome, so they didn't want naked statues visible. So the Italians put bed sheets basically over the statues. I mean, is that nuts? It's our country. You don't like it? Don't.
It's these are signs of a dying civilization.
I fear you're right. The good news is that if we talk about it, if people read about it, maybe they'll be able to stand up and say enough is enough. I will tell you that there are so many fairy tales coming out of the media outlets today that it's really hard for the average person. I think you asked me a while back, and I just want to articulate a little bit better. The reason we wrote the book, so that people could pass it around as well. The book is best bought as an ebook because you get the links and you can just touch the link and you go to the site that we found. Caveat, a lot of the sites will probably be dead links after a while if, you know, the authorities decide, oh, we don't want to show the migrants in a bad light anymore.
Yeah.
The paperback book is over 500 pages, but the deal we have with Amazon, which is where it is exclusively, is that if you buy the paperback, you get the electronic version for free. So if you have an entrepreneurial bend, you buy the paperback, keep the electronic version, and then give the paperback to a friend or someone who's traveling to Europe and scare the heck out of them. You know, maybe they'll be more aware when they get there. But whatever it is, it's a conversation that's got to be going on. And I will tell you, we don't see many people talking about it.
Well, I wanted to ask you as we begin to round up, well, one, we have to tell people where they can get your book. And two, what are some other points that we missed that you feel important to share?
The book is on Amazon, so you just go on Amazon, type in Hasta la Vista Europe, Colonel Walter T. Richmond, and you'll just go straight to the link and you can get it on Amazon either way. Again, ebook or paperback with a free ebook. I will tell you that the healthcare thing is terrifying, right? So one of the major problems is healthcare. They're not set up for all these extra people with all these extra illnesses. Lana, what happens when people are confined in a small space? They get nasty things like typhoid, right? Things breed when they're in small places where they're all crammed together. And that's what's happening with the migrants. They're all in these little confined shelters. They pass around diseases, and it's going to be on a scale that they've never seen. Germany is experiencing it, but they're pretty much effectively hiding it. But there are things like plague and Ebola and things the German doctors said they've only read about in books.
So we might be getting another black plague situation in Europe. And, you know, it was the Asians that brought that, by the way.
Yes, yes. Very few people know that. But you're right. I will tell you that it is just so incredibly scary to think about what could happen with the healthcare part of it. Another thing I'd like to mention is arson. A lot of times you'll see in the papers or online that there was an arson and they try to immediately attribute it to racists, right?
Yeah.
The last arson we read about was actually in a shelter, and it was the actual migrants who used to disable the smoke alarms because they would smoke in the shelter, right?
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand no smoking inside a building. So, you know, there's the smoke detector. Let's break it, unwind it, unscrew it, take out the battery, whatever, and we can smoke inside instead of outside. And here's the problem. The media told the story thusly. They said, wow, some sicko racists decided to burn down the shelter and they disabled the smoke alarm so everyone would die. You get the picture?
Yeah.
Where
sure.
It's really the migrants smoking inside who disabled the alarms because they kept going off. So I think that the arson thing, whenever we see arson right now, we instantly have a red flag and say, is it really anti-migrant or is it something else? We had a whole chapter or section in the book on school arsons, out of control in Sweden, one or two a day. And it's mostly in migrant neighborhoods. The crime statistics are crazy.
I just wanted to add real quick about the fires. I spoke to someone in Finland, you know, we were doing a show on environmentalism and basically how this is a refugee crisis is unsustainable for the environment for a lot of different reasons, infrastructure. And some of these people, you know, they come from kind of more primitive societies and they don't understand what ovens are or running water. They leave the water running because they think it'll stop if they turn it off. Sometimes they would try and make a fire right inside the apartment on the floor to cook. I mean, they do things like that.
Yes. And we actually found evidence of that. It's a little bit disheartening for us because we'll see a huge story. Arson at a migrant shelter, racists sought, xenophobes. The police are looking for the xenophobes who did it. And then we can't find the follow-up story. And when we did occasionally find a follow-up story, it was, oh, gee, shucks. Oh, those crazy migrants, they tried to cook on the floor, as you said, or, you know, they were smoking and they didn't realize, you know, you throw the cigarette outside, it could actually ignite something. And you're right. A lot of times the explanation is simple, but they'll tell you the big line. And one of the other ways the media subterfuges or deceives people is by not telling the whole story. They'll throw the big thing out there and then they'll hold back. The Viking Cruise Line is an excellent example. There were this woman was raped by 8 men on the Viking Cruise Line outside of the Netherlands, Finland area, etc., right? So instantly, the press was so thrilled to report 8 Swedes rape woman. Not one of them was Swedish.
Yep.
They were all citizens of African and Middle Eastern countries. So they're also very quick to deceive you by not correcting their mistakes. And I think the third way that the media really likes to subterfuge is by ignoring stuff. How powerful is that to ignore it? Not to give someone a platform or a story a platform. You can just as effectively or sometimes more effectively undermine the truth by not reporting it at all, not twisting it. You don't have to twist it. You don't have to bend it. You don't have to spin it. Just ignore it. And that's another way that we've seen it's just not being covered. And I think, you know, there's just so much. We could sit here for another 2 hours, 3 hours, 5 hours.
I know, and I really appreciate it. And you've done a really good job on the book, so I'd encourage people to pick that up and tell people where they can get it.
Amazon.com, just Hostel of Easter Europe. I think you had a link on the website.
Yes, we'll have one. Well, Walter, thank you so much. I know it's kind of a grim topic, and I think that as things get worse, hopefully more Europeans will wake up and organize and do something about it. So I'm still holding out that people will rise up and take their countries back. But I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I know it's doom and gloom, but I have hope for Europe. Europe has been through all kinds of turbulent wars, conflicts, and hardships, and she will rise again. All of this can and will be reversed in Europe. Maybe not in our lifetime, but it will happen. America, however, I'm sad to say I feel the majority of people in this country will surrender to the blob that is the melting pot and be lost forever into the sludge. This country will slowly turn darker and darker on many levels. Maybe a few pockets of people like us will remain, but it won't be easy. Maybe at that point they'll consider going back to Europe. And maybe at that point Europe will open the doors to help bring back Europeans to their homeland. That is my hope anyway. Although we spend some time in America, the door is closing very soon. It's back to Europe for good. I think it's an important time to plan for the long term. Things are going to change rapidly. So how and where will you survive what is coming? It's not being paranoid, it's being realistic. No one will help us when the time comes when we need help. So it's best to think, how can we be self-sufficient and work toward that goal? Preferably with some close friends and relatives who think like you do. Hard times are coming for white folks, but we're European. We overcome and we make a way. Have a great weekend, everyone. And please consider sending a donation to this show or sign up for a Red Ice membership to access over 1,000 shows because we do need your help. It's not easy doing what we do, and it's very stressful at times. Without our listeners who support us, we couldn't do this because 3 shows a week, news, and extra videos take an unbelievable amount of time, and everything I do is free. But hey, the Jews gave me a clothing line. Yeah, people actually have said that. But stop by my new store, lanaslama.com, to see my organic and natural fiber clothing line. I'm just getting going, and so I appreciate the support in my early days. It's another hard path to forge. Visit redicemembers.com or radio314.com, where you'll see the big clickable buttons to help support us. Everything we do goes back into this site and enables our tiny team to live while we create content. I have some good shows coming up next, so check back in about a week. Bye for now.